You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections. We'll change the tone a bit. We had Julie in, but now we've being the second Wednesday of the month between 1 and 2, we have our friends from Hutchinson Legal in and to talk all things legal. Now, I can't offer you to ring up Greg today because we don't have anyone in the office. Greg's on holidays, bit of a slacker, but anyway. But next week, or if you want anything answered between now and next month, just send us an email to info@yarravalleyfm.org.au. And we'll get them answered. But first of all, we interviewed the head honcho. That's Grant Hutchinson from Hutchinson Legal. Welcome, Grant.
G'day, Alan. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you too. And also Alan from a division of which is called Your Lawyer. Welcome, Alan.
Hello, Alan. Nice to meet another Alan.
Now, we're not going too well. Could you say that again, please?
Alan. Nice to meet another Alan.
Yeah, I think we're going to... Probably we
can swap chairs when it gets.
I think we might have to. Yeah, all right. Okay. So the question was, and I'm not having it go at any government. I don't want to get involved in political stuff, but during the at some stage, the government said that they were going to review the bail, and they now have said they've brought them into effect. And the question was, and we've had more than three or four people. We've had quite a number of people. This bail stuff is just causing us a whole lot of grief to a lot of people. So, first of all, are they changes that are going to alter the bail? And secondly, how is it going to be applied? And the third one question, a part of all that, was how can... are there let-out clauses? Because some of these legislation, they say, oh, yeah, but under circumstances, under this and that. So I guess, Grant, you've had a look at it, or someone there has. Can you tell us what the outcome was, please?
Yeah, look, the whole concept of bail laws are around when should somebody who's been charged with an offence be allowed to, relying on the presumption of innocence,
yep,
before found guilty, be allowed to be released into the community, or should they be held in on remand?
So that's, now, one, and this comes up, and you've been here when it's come up. We've got people out there 50 times on bail, and the question is always, if they didn't take notice 1, 2, or 3, why are they going to take notice of 50, 51, or 52?
Well, this is must be very disheartening for our law enforcement officers to be finding, and the changes that were made in this term of government have effectively made it so much easier for those people to get bail again and again and again.
Absolutely, because there's no such thing now as breach of bail, is there?
Well, let's turn to that in a minute. Right. I think you're listening to your son a bit too much there. It's not quite, okay. If that was the case, then Tony Mockbell might have had something to answer for. I think he absconded while on bail.
Yep.
But anyway, that was a bad hair day.
That used to be a thing, though, wasn't it? Breach of bail.
Yes, absolutely. And it still is a thing. So I'll get to that. So the Bail Act is a piece of legislation that principally deals with how those in a judicial position should deal with decisions relating to when to give bail and when not to give bail. So it's been subjected to significant changes over the past decade, but it's never been... There's been two attempts to tighten it, and some would say it's still not tight enough, and others would say maybe they've got the balance right. I think that the question, what they had said, there were a couple of cases, one of an Indigenous person dying on remand. When they looked at what led to them not being given bail, they thought that it didn't seem fair, and so that led to a loosening and a loosening and a loosening of the bail laws. But then did it go too far? Well, the government said yes, it did go too far, so we need to tighten things up. So the most recent changes were announced by the Premier, and that was following the resignation of the Victorian Police Commissioner, Shane Patton, in February of this year. There was pressure from the opposition, who accused the state government of being weak on crime, and there was a rise in crime, particularly youth crime, and involving home break-ins and car thefts that were being reported in the media. So on the 21st of March, there was a bill amending the Bail Act, It was called getting tough or something. I don't want to use the word tough.
Yeah.
Anyone who keeps talking about how tough they are, anyway.
Generally aren't, but anyway.
I'll let you warm it. Anyway, it's since, so within less than a week, it's coming to force on the 26th of March, and basically it amends the guiding principles of the Bail Act to elevate the importance of recognising community safety. This is what the stated objective is.
Yep.
So that's so yes, normally the presumption of innocence, but now we need to look at, and the right to liberty, but now we need to look at community safety. So they've removed references to remand of children being a last resort, and community safety is now an overarching priority when you consider bail.
Right.
Also, they've created new offences of committing an indictable offence while on bail, Section 30, capital B, and also they've also brought in things under the Summary Offences Act to provide that it's an offence to contravene or conduct yourself in a way that is contrary to the bail conditions. It's also made changes to what offences constitute a Schedule 1 and Schedule 2 offence. Now, this is where it gets interesting, and I can see I'm piquing your interest.
Well, I'm a bit worried when a legal eagle says to me, this is where it gets interesting. I'm not sure what that means.
So, if you're not likely to get bail in Schedule 1 and Schedule 2 offences. So Schedule 1 would be... So this is where they say these are really serious. The question is, what do they leave out? I'll come to that in a moment.
Yep.
But Schedule 1, so if murder, drug trafficking, aggravated carjackings, then you have to satisfy an exceptional circumstance in order to get bail.
And who decides what the exceptional circumstance is? The judge.
The judge, yes.
Right.
So
or magistrate.
Yes, or whoever's the presiding officer. Yep. And for Schedule 2, you must establish that you have compelling reasons why you should be granted bail. Now, the question here, has it gone far enough? And I know listeners are very keen to see that, has the government gone far enough? This was in a speech from a fellow, Michael O'Brien, and he said, well, for example, the government doesn't believe that the offence of the crime of robbery is deserving of being under their tough.
So, oh, right.
The government does not believe that the crime of burglary is deserving of this tough stance. They're not Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 offences. The government doesn't even believe that arson, and in the Yarra Valley, that doesn't constitute Schedule 1 or Schedule 2. Think of, and in his
so
speech,
these are actually excluded.
Excluded from the particular test. So if it's test, if it's Schedule 1, then it has to be exceptional circumstances. Schedule 2, you have to show compelling reasons why you should be granted bail. It shouldn't be a presumption that you get bail.
But these ones you're talking about...
They were left out of Schedule 1, left out of Schedule 2. And that's what I think... So people would say it's not as tough as it was 2 years ago. So they've wound it back, but have they wound it back enough? We're not making comments on this.
No.
But think of all the tobacco... all the people who run these tobacco shops that wake up or they go to bed at night, as Michael said, not knowing whether the next morning they'll still have a shop because they'll be firebombed or something.
Yeah. So, and the other issue with that is that some of these places now are underneath apartments, aren't they?
They are. So I think if you kill someone, that's
but it could very easily, someone can get badly injured.
Yes.
Anyway, sorry.
No, but the government are seeking to target knife crime by banning machetes. So there's other things that are and prohibiting certain weapons with exemptions. Obviously, if you're on a farm, you might need a machete.
Yep.
But you don't need it at the supermarket.
But let me ask you, and be the devil's advocate.
For sure.
How many of the machetes are bought through legal means and how many are bought through other means? I mean, it's all right, they've banned a lot of guns, but the underworld doesn't walk into the local gun shop and buy a gun, do they?
I don't know that it's... Alan, you might know differently, but I don't think either of us profess knowledge. I think the what was being concerning was you'd go to a flea market or to a market and you'd buy any knife you like. And they were quite, who knows, pick up a pot plant, free machete thrown in. So who knows what they're doing these days. I'm exaggerating, of course, but... the thought is there really do need to be harsher penalties when community safety, when people just aren't feeling safe. And should it be that young people, one of these questions is, when should you be protecting the society above all, and when should you be allowing people the presumption of innocence and going free? So Schedule 1 and Schedule 2, and they've left out quite a few that could have been dealt with in that area. But, look, it's one of those things that it's too early to comment
how effective it's...
Well, but you can almost know these are the offences that can't be out... Well, that some people in the community would feel they might not have got it right yet. So,
all right. I've got to take a quick break, and we're back with more.
Step ahead of you, stay in motion, keep an open mind. Love is a race won by two. Your emotion, my solitude. If I stop, I could lose my head, so I'm losing you instead.
Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to the Legal Hour with our friends from Hutchinson Legal, and we're going to talk to Alan, and he's a personal injury lawyer. Alan, let me ask you off the top of your head, it's pretty hard. What's the most complicated case you've had in personal injury? Because you tell me, well, you've only been with your lawyer a fairly short time, you've had quite a lot of experience in personal injury.
Well, Alan, thank you for asking me the hardest possible question you could from the outset. I must say, I'm from your lawyer, the sister firm of Hutchinson Legal upstairs. Yep. So the daughter firm, the sister firm,
The related firm upstairs.
The most complicated claim I can think of off the top of my head might have been a medical law case where the patient saw various GPs at the same clinic over a period of months and years, and then eventually doctor number 9 at that clinic said, hang on, something's wrong here. And from there, we worked out that the person had a serious personal injury caused by the negligence of doctors 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9.
Just because they missed them.
Missed the diagnosis along the way, despite various clues.
So, Alan, when, well, let's just talk about personal injury. So someone's walking down the road and they trip over. They trip, well, first of all, we'll do it two ways. First of all, they trip over a, because you often see on a footpath where a tree root has lifted part of the thing.
Yes.
So someone trips over that. Is the person at fault themselves, or can you sue the council? Because the council can't be walking around every footpath every day. So, but they do have a duty of care, don't they?
That's exactly right, and it's always that balancing act. Every case depends on its own individual circumstances, of course.
Yeah.
But, and the basic step is, to use a pun, was the council in breach of its duty to look after the road user that happened to be going past that area in the first place.
Yep.
When you ask the question, is the person at fault, that's the step you ask after you've asked that first step, because it's only when you show that the council's been found to be at blame that you then take the next step. Oh, should we take 10% off for your own silly misadventure, or 20% off, or 30% off?
Yeah, that was my next question I was going to say to you. Do you then have to, if a person, well, just use this instance, the person's fallen over, do you then have to say, well, hang on, you did contribute to this or not?
Well, that's where you're digging deep. Did they trip over the tree root? Did they just fall over? Were they having a medical episode and that's why they fell in the first place?
Oh, right.
There's always a question behind why someone has a fall in the first place.
Yep.
So they're the sort of things you've got to dig into in great detail. And really, you're wanting to get from your client a consistent story about what exactly has happened.
Yep.
And you want that reported to the authority as soon as possible. And you want a chance for you and or your lawyer to get and look at the scene where it happened before it gets repaired or modified or fixed up or degrades even further.
All right. So when you're talking personal injury, are you talking about in the car, walking, or at work, or all the above?
D, Alan, D.
Which is D?
D is answer, all of the above.
Right.
All of the above.
Yep.
I've been doing this for 28 years. I'm an accredited specialist in personal injury law.
Yep.
So I'll look after someone who's been injured at work, even if it's been their own silly mistake or if it's someone else's fault.
Yep.
In their car, whether it's in the driveway or whether it's on the road, if they're injured by a moving motor vehicle, it's still a claim.
Yeah.
And a medical law claim or a public liability claim or a sexual abuse claim, some of those awful things as well.
And with motor vehicles, there's no fault, isn't it?
With the work cover and the motor vehicle claims, yes. As I said, there's a lump sum compensation scheme, regardless of how it's happened. No fault.
Alan, this is probably a hard question to ask you, and I'm not after free legal advice because this situation happened years ago. But I was involved with an organisation that does something every year, just once a year, 2 days a year, and then nothing until the next year. Somebody got injured by doing something that they'd claimed they've always done. And the judge in that, because it went to court, and the judge in that case found that you should, if you're only doing something every now and again, that it's the duty is on the person that asked that person to do the job to make sure they knew that what to do this year, because you can't rely on they did it the year before and the year before. Is that a fair comment? And I'm not ever going to judge.
Oh, neither am I. Isn't it about, if you're going to do it properly, or don't do it at all?
Yeah.
Is that's the underlying message I'd get from that?
Yeah, and but what I'm sort of saying is it the duty of the person to make sure that you know how to do it properly, even though you might have done it the last 10 years, but only once a year.
So you're talking about the people who ran the show the year before, making sure that when they hand it over to the new group of people, that they know the pitfalls, the
one person
the traps.
Has done the same job every year.
Yes.
But it was they were told you should have made sure, because you can't guarantee the person remembers what they did last year.
Oh, that's getting a bit hard for me, Alan. getting a bit hard for me. Maybe when I've done 30 years, I'll have a better answer for you, or I should read the judgment.
All right, we'll take a break, and we're going to come back because we did have a question about what a committee can do.
You were young and your heart was an open book. You used to say, live and let live.
the live and let die. Live and let
Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, Grant, we had a question last month about a committee and regarding the financial side of it.
Sure.
How did you go on that, please?
Well, let me repeat the question as I understand it. Are committee members responsible for a debt of a sporting club that is an incorporated association when they're making a loss of, say, $1,000,
yep,
and then they pay another $6,000 as an honorarium or wages to the company, to their club secretary?
Yep. So is it legal to take a $1,000 debt and make it a $7,000 debt?
Well, let me deal with can I just say it's one of those difficult things. When it comes to publicly listed companies or companies, it's quite interesting. You can be making a loss in a particular part and still pay a dividend in that part of the year based on previous profits.
Right.
So there is an ability to do those things, often because there's a robustness to them and an ability to keep going.
Yep.
You're dealing here with an incorporated association. So incorporation basically means that this sporting club is a separate legal entity. It's not the members of the committee that are all personally liable, but the committee is a separate, the incorporated association is a separate legal entity. And so they actually have some shield from personal liability.
Right.
Some protection.
Yep.
So basically being incorporated allows the club to enter into contracts, borrow money, own property, sue or be sued.
Yep.
Club members are not personally liable as long as they fulfil their legal obligations. So to answer the above scenario, you've got to first ask, is the company solvent? It could have in the current year made a loss of $1,000,
yeah,
but previously made significant profits. So they could have huge monies in reserve. Just because you have one quarter or one year where you make a loss doesn't mean that you don't have the ability based on reserves. So just your current trading doesn't determine your ability. So the first question is it solvent? If it's not able to pay its debts as and when they fall due, which is the general test, then it would be unwise to incur liabilities because people can be personally liable when they allow an incorporated or a company to incur debts when they have no reasonable expectation that those debts would be paid as and when they fall due. So it's how the committee handles the financial affairs. Committee members must ensure the association does not continue to trade, incurring debts when it's insolvent. So getting to the question of the office holders, including the committee members, do they have a duty? Well, there are civil penalties that can apply to office holders under Section 83(2). There's a breach of a duty of care and diligence that might apply. But also, they're required under the Act to have indemnity insurance. They're required to uphold the financial viability. They've got to think of the incorporated association as if it's its own person. And their obligation is to look after that body. So particularly the people on the committee have a real obligation to make sure that, that they shouldn't... it's not their alter ego. It's not all about them. It's about how do we preserve and look after this entity. It's I wouldn't call it a baby in a crib, but it has nobody to speak up for it except the people that are on the committee, and they need to look after it.
It's so when we're talking about incorporation, I know you said it's got it gives you a bit of I don't know the words you use, but a bit of a break. Like it isolates the
direct... shield.
Yeah, a shield.
They talk about the corporate veil, but anyway, it's something that protects you from...
If you do something stupid, like I understand if you act legally and do everything right, but if you do something stupid, then that surely that veil's not going to be there.
Well, if you breach the law, then there are penalties that apply. So there are civil penalties, and if you're incurring debts with no reasonable expectation that they would be paid as and when they fall due, then the committee members can become liable in the event of the insolvency putting the company under.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk to Alan again.
They don't understand you. You're fine.
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Alan, I've sort of brushed past what we were talking about, your personal injuries a bit, because I had promised somebody that we would get them that answer as early as I could today about the committee, because I know somebody's quite concerned about it. So you're involved with personal injury. So how do you decide as to what level of personal injury it is? I mean, obviously there's a person falls over in the footpath, they maybe break an arm or they scuff themselves up and break their glasses or something like that. That's certainly nowhere near as serious as a person who's become a quadriplegic or something like that. So are there... Well, there must be levels, but how do you find out what those levels are as a lawyer?
Well, as a lawyer, you should know it at first instance.
Yeah, I suppose you should.
But it comes really down to the reason you've suffered the injury in the first place. If it's at work, there are thresholds for bringing a permanent impairment lump sum claim. 5% for your spine, 10% or more for other physical injuries, 30% for psychiatric injury, for example.
There are levels of injury that are already prescribed. Like, you don't have to go to court to prove 5% of your spine. It's automatically there.
No, well, there's an entire process you've got to go through. You know, right. The thresholds are different in TA, in motor vehicle claims, transport accident claims. The thresholds are different again in medical law and public liability claims when you trip over in the supermarket or on a footpath, as I said before.
Sorry, I don't want to cut across you.
No, it's okay.
But are they designed by the fact that you've had more input into it, into the injury? Or you say there's different thresholds.
Yeah.
Why are there different thresholds?
When the work cover scheme was born in 85 and the transport accident scheme in 87,
yep,
they said, okay, we were to compensate certain levels of permanent injury if you're above a minimum threshold. And they went and found an American green book
called
the AMA guides, and they used that for a while. And then they moved on in about 1998 to the red book, the American Medical Association Guides to the Evaluation of Permanent Impairment, 4th edition. And then from there, the TAC and work cover schemes and eventually public liability and medical law schemes sort of built systems saying, okay, you've got to exceed certain thresholds in those guidelines to be able to bring a claim. If you don't have an injury that's bad enough, tough luck.
No.
Maybe you can get your out-of-pocket expenses for your glasses and your medicals, but maybe nothing else.
Yep.
And from there, the psychiatric guidelines got rewritten into a separate set of rules,
right,
and for work cover and TAC claims, there's now a separate set of guidelines for some spinal injuries as well.
So, Alan, just let me ask you: you could have, we'll say it's a work injury, just for instance.
Yes.
So you could have two workers side by side who have two completely different claims, injured the same way because one might have inputted more than the other one. Is that what you're saying?
Well, you might have the two people driving in the course of their employment and one's the driver who runs off the road and hits the tree and one's the passenger in the same vehicle going to the same job, working for the same employer at the same time,
yep,
suffering a different injury from the same situation. And that first worker who was driving the car,
yep,
in the course of their employment is going to have a work cover claim for their medical bills for life, for their wages for a while.
Yep.
And if they've got a permanent injury that's above the threshold in the red guidelines,
yep,
they're going to get a lump sum regardless of blame. But that passenger, the passenger in the same car, same vehicle, same time,
yep,
same employer, they'll have a second and separate claim, a common law claim as well. And it'll depend on who was to blame. Was it the employer's fault that the car crashed somehow, or was it the driver's fault that the car crashed? And they'd be able to bring a common law claim for their pain and suffering and their loss of wages over and above the lump sum they get.
Oh, so they'd get a lump sum the same, not necessarily, when I say same, I don't mean the same dollars.
The same guidelines, different injuries get different amounts of compensation.
Right.
I understand what I mean by
but
saying.
Also depending on the driver could get more than, say, the passenger.
Well, it depends. If the driver's a paraplegic and the passenger's got a broken leg, under that sort of example, the driver would be getting a certain amount regardless of fault through the lump sum impairment compensation scheme.
Oh.
And the passenger would be getting based on his or her level of injury, they'd be getting the lump sum and they'd be getting a common law pain and suffering and wages settlement as well.
All right.
There's innumerable examples. You might have a paramedic who's injured coming to render assistance to them at the same time as well, and she'd have a claim as well.
All right, we've got to take a quick break, and then I want to, because we've got a question for Graham to get us an answer on post.
And gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, Grant, I want to ask, well, I don't want to. We've had a listener come to us with a question, and we always say we'll get them answered.
Yep.
All right, so a person goes to court, all the evidence is against them, and they're found guilty. Job done. All of a sudden, somebody finds out that evidence wasn't gained quite as legal as it should be.
Yes.
So they want to get a retrial. I'm sure you can see where this is going.
Yeah, I think.
But why can't you, or can you use, if why can't you use that evidence if it's been got some other way, even though the evidence was never disputed? I guess this listener is saying, well, why doesn't the evidence stand if the evidence is the evidence? But it can
is
it
get the new evidence or the old evidence?
No, the old evidence.
But if new evidence is found, why is
no, the only evidence was found that evidence wasn't gained necessarily legally.
Okay, yes, I think I know which case.
You know where we're going?
Last week that you're talking about.
Yes. I'm not saying that. And therefore I want to be very careful how we do it. And we're not going to talk about that case. I don't want to know anything about that case. But what we want to know is, why all of a sudden is that evidence not any good? Even though the evidence may not have been disputed, but it's the way it was collected why does that alter the outcome?
Hmm, great question. Thanks for that. I do think I could have dealt with, because somebody was granted bail last week in interesting circumstances.
Careful, yeah.
Oh, no, I think you can just report about it. It's worthwhile, and I could deal with that rather than what you're talking about is a retrial based on new evidence.
No, I'm not talking about that at all.
Just the fact that evidence is tainted.
I'm talking about what you're talking about. Okay. I'm taking that on board, what you're talking about, because that's the exact... But I don't want to get on air saying we're going to discuss that case.
Okay. So, well, of course not.
So we want to know...
Because we wouldn't discuss that case. We just want to discuss... So,
well,
if
in the general rule,
so if
how did that come about? Not how did it come about. Why can't it be used?
Okay. Well, let's. I don't want to keep you in suspense for a whole month, but we'll come back to you next month. And I know you'll be excited to hear.
Well, I told the listener that we can't get an answer for a month because we've. That's how we work, and it's All right, let's go. Let's not go any further with that.
Let's change the topic.
We've got about 3-4 minutes, so let's change the subject. What else you got to talk about?
Well, vicarious liability or vicarious trauma.
Vicarious, what's that mean?
Well, vicarious is it's a term, vicarious liability. It's basically somebody becoming responsible as a result of the acts of another, I think. Anyway, right. Vicarious trauma, let's say you go to work and each day you have to deal with, you're stuck in a little studio, no one to talk to, and over the years and you keep hearing sad stories and eventually you get depressed.
Yep.
That's as a result of your work, you become depressed. Is there a claim that could be made and how do we deal with that in life? How do we deal with workplaces?
I don't know. You tell me.
I think it's a great question, but one of the things is I think to be self-aware, to understand what's going on in your life, to recognise that you may need time out. Sometimes that's dealt with through, I think, I hope this isn't a politically incorrect term, but black humour. It probably is politically incorrect.
Yeah, but you can't use that now.
No, I can't use it. Okay, well, humour that is off colour.
Yeah, but you can't use that in any workplace.
Absolutely, but one of the past things, or people could joke and laugh about things, and that was a way of letting off steam, or they can yell and scream. They could do whatever they want to, but to bottle it up is not a good thing.
Yeah. I believe back in the old days that some of the AMBOs and that, because they see some shocking sides that none of us would want to see, that they did use those sorts of jokes. But you've only got to have some person in the room when you tell it, and you're up the proverbial.
Yep. No, look, we're not excusing or authorising, But I don't think what we are saying is that it's not a good idea to bottle it up.
No.
You've got to have a way of... now, sometimes you can go and see a psychologist.
Yep.
And I think the government has... I think there's talk of 10 appointments becoming 20 or is it 5 becoming 10? I don't know. Oh, here we go. It's to 6. You can get 6 appointments. So you can go to your GP. The problem is getting an appointment with a good psychologist. Get a psychologist that has an opening because it's so hard.
Particularly, and I don't want to get political here, as you know.
No,
but they tell me since COVID that and I know because I've interviewed some people and they say since COVID it's extremely hard to get people in to see psychologists.
It is. It's a... you wouldn't have thought that there was going to be such an explosion of need, but there is. And so the idea is not to tough it out, to ride it out, to be that, or just go and drink it off at the pub. That's not a good idea. It's better is to talk to a professional. It is sometimes worth talking to a friend. Sometimes that can help. I wouldn't say that's the only answer, but I think to just bottle it up is not a good thing. But have somebody who is able to listen and empathise and try to not just almost compound the problem, but try to encourage you when there's a real need beyond what they can handle to go somewhere else.
We've got about 30 seconds. Sure. Alan, just one quick question. Does sexual abuse and those things come under personal injury?
Absolutely.
So it doesn't have to actually be an arm or a leg, or it can be...
A lot of the sexual abuse claims are excluded from all of these thresholds and time limits. So something that happened a long time ago can be looked at again or looked at for the first time now.
Can it? So it could be 30, 40 years ago.
Correct.
And because...
Because it's so terrible.
Well, and the police have a lot more training to deal with sexual abuse now, don't they, than what they did, say, 40 years ago or 30 years ago.
I can't speak for that time, but it's different, the training they have now.
All right, got to go. Thank you, guys, Grant and Alan, for coming in. Always a pleasure to see Grant.
And it's always good to see you, Alan. It's, and even to hear you on a Sunday as I'm travelling around. So.